Welcome. You're listening to the Malcontent News Russia-Ukraine War Podcast, the show that cuts through the fog of war and updates you about the ongoing conflict in Ukraine, with your host, Linnea Hubbard. Don't forget to like, comment, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts.
I'm Linnea Hubbard, and today is Thursday, February 2nd, 2023. It's been 3,263 days since Russia occupied Crimea on February 27, 2014, and 344 days since the large-scale invasion of Ukraine began. Today's podcast looks at what happened yesterday in the Russia-Ukraine war. The Malcontent News Russia-Ukraine War Report is compiled by our team from around the world. Today's report includes information from direct contacts in Ukraine and their proxies, Russian Ministry of Defense reports, the General Staff of the Armed Forces of Ukraine reports, operational commands north, south, and east of Ukraine, open source intelligence, our in-house team of analysts and geolocation experts, and pro-Ukrainian and pro-Russian mill bloggers and social media accounts with a track record of trying to be accurate. We have one mission: to report the truth, because the truth matters. Let's start with our assessment of the current status of the war. First, we maintain that the battle for the control of Bakhmut has reached a critical phase, with the addition of Russian forces to the Axis and the ongoing attempt to create a technical encirclement. Second, we concur with recent assessments by other analysts that it is highly likely the Russian Federation will launch a new offensive before February 24th, to try and deliver a tactical victory before the anniversary of the wide-scale invasion of Ukraine. Third, we maintain that the significant increase in disinformation and misinformation from Russian sources is being directed by Chief of the General Staff of the Russian Federation Armed Forces, Valery Gerasimov, as part of his hybrid warfare doctrine. Fourth, the RAND Corporation agreed with our assessment that Ukraine holds the battlefield initiative, while we maintain the exception for the Soledar-Bakhmut axis. Fifth, we maintain that the Russian military within Ukraine remains combat ineffective and is relying on World War II tactics that Field Marshal Georgi Zhukov would recognize to move the line of conflict. Sixth, we maintain that the power struggle between military leaders aligned with Russian Minister of Defense Sergei Shoigu versus those aligned with private military company or PMC Wagner Group head Yevgeny Prigozhin is continuing, with Russian President Vladimir Putin benefiting from the political distraction. Seventh, we maintain that punitive missile and drone strikes targeting civilians and civilian infrastructure will continue. Eighth, we maintain that Russian forces will continue to target electrical, heating, and potable water infrastructure. Ninth, we maintain that the Russian Federation's inventory of caliber cruise missiles is critically low based on the continued decline of launches from the Black Sea Fleet. Tenth, we maintain that there is a risk of a nuclear accident caused by the de-energization of Ukrainian nuclear power plants as a result of Russian electrical infrastructure destruction. 11th, we maintain that stealth mobilization has started in the Russian Federation due to stop-loss orders for active-duty troops deployed in Ukraine and mobilization requests from the Kremlin in the occupied territories. And finally, we maintain that the threat of Russian forces in Belarus crossing into Ukraine as part of an offensive operation is negligible. Let's get some regional updates, starting with the Donbas region in Luhansk. Multiple reports of an imminent Russian offensive from the Kremina operational area didn't pan out. Artillery intensity increased, but is still not indicative of setting conditions for a larger offensive. There continues to be positional fighting, with one Russian source claiming Ukraine went on the offensive. In the Svatova operational direction, mercenaries with Rybar reported that Russian DRG units tested Ukrainian defenses in Novoselivske, while the Russian Ministry of Defense, or MOD, reported Ukrainian positions were shelled. In the Kremina operational direction, the General Staff of the Armed Forces of Ukraine, or GSAFU, reported Chervonopopivka was shelled. Rybar claimed Ukrainian forces launched an offensive from the settlement, which reportedly did not move the line of conflict. Russian and Ukrainian sources reported artillery exchanges in the areas of Kremina, Dibrova, and Kuzmina, and Rybar reported that positional fighting occurred near Dibrova. In Russian-occupied Severodonetsk, the political party United Russia and propagandists with Rydovka opened up heating tents, as the humanitarian situation in the city has reached a crisis level. Despite promises to restore electricity and heat before the winter, the estimated 8,000 remaining residents don't have power, water, or natural gas. Promises to supply the area with firewood and coal were not kept. To the surprise of no one at this point. Assessment here. Yesterday, Russian forces struck Slovyansk and Kramatorsk with S-300 anti-aircraft missiles used for a ground attack and at least one Iskander short-range ballistic missile, or SRBM. Because the cities are logistics hubs and integral to the ground lines of communication, called GLOCs, those are supply lines, supporting Bakhmut to the south and Liman and Siversk to the east, we cannot assess that these strikes were specifically to set conditions for a Russian Kremina offensive. What we would assess as setting conditions are disruption of logistics, supply interdiction, suppress and destroy enemy air defense, clearing routes through minefields, and large-scale artillery strikes. And we haven't seen this activity occurring. Luhansk Oblast Administrative and Military Governor Serhii Haidai said that Russian forces had not formed so-called strike groups in Kremina, and there were only pockets of heavy fighting, which we assess continues to be between squad and platoon-sized units. In northeast Donetsk, in the Kremina operational direction, Russian forces led by the 2nd Army Corps of the Luhansk People's Republic, or LNR, attacked in the direction of Yampolivka for the third day. Russian milblogger Vysoki Govorit claimed that the Russian 144th Guards Motor Rifle Infantry Brigade... Russian 144th Guards Motor Rifle Division was 2 kilometers away from the settlement. Some assessment here. Govorit claimed that the 144th advanced 300 to 700 meters in the last 24 hours. But to be within 2 kilometers of Yampolivka would have required a 7.5-kilometer advance across open fields based on the geolocated and known line of conflict. We do not consider this claim to be credible due to the sharp increase in information warfare from Kremlin-backed sources since Valery Gerasimov became the commander of Russian forces in Ukraine. In the Siversk operational area, fighting east of Spirne continued. The situation remains difficult for Ukrainian forces in the Soledar operational area. On January 29th, we assessed Sakhovy-Vinseti had been captured based on social media reports and terrain analysis. On February 1st, PMC Wagner's social media channels published a picture of mercenaries in the village. Russian forces, supported by PMC Wagner, attempted to advance on Rozdolivka through Mikulaivka, but did not make new territorial gains. PMC Wagner released a video showing mercenaries at a Blahudatne bus stop a day after the Russian MOD made a second claim that the village was captured. The GSAFU reported an offensive in the area was repulsed, and in our assessment, this was an attempt to advance south into Krasnohora. Fighting continued for control of Krasnohora, with Ukrainian forces holding their defensive positions and Russian forces claiming that Ukrainian reinforcements were brought into the settlement. In the Bakhmut operational area, fighting continued on the city's northern and eastern edges. The composite forces of Russian troops and PMC Wagner continued attempts to advance on Paraskovivka. There were unconfirmed reports that Russian forces made incremental gains advancing west. Pavlo Kirilenko, Donetsk Oblast Administrative and Military Governor, reported the settlement was heavily shelled. Rybar reported that fighting continued in the areas of the meatpacking plant and champagne factory. The 1st Battalion of the Azov 3rd Assault Brigade led a light infantry assault in the dachas northeast of Bakhmut, supported by armor. A geolocated and weather-confirmed video showed a squad of dead Russian troops in the dachas on the eastern edge of the forest plantation, and a Ukrainian squad calmly on patrol. We geolocated a second video and moved the line of conflict east based on the updated intelligence. Now, as with most of the photos and videos we reference, we do link to them in our full situation report on Patreon, but fair warning, some may find the second video disturbing. Our assessment here? Ukrainian forces made marginal gains and cleared the Dachas in northeastern Bakhmut. In the Kostyantynivka operational direction, the situation was unchanged. The most intense fighting in Ukraine was west and north of Klishiivka, with Ukrainian forces holding defensive lines at the canal to the west and 2.5 to 3 kilometers south of Ivanivske. Residents in Chasiv Yar reported they could hear frequent artillery coming from the east, indicating that Russian forces continue to advance, and there is significant pressure on the T-504 highway Glock. In southwest Donetsk, in the Toretsk-New York operational area, the Russian MOD claims that Russian forces advanced on Nelepivka and took up, quote, advantageous positions. Some assessment here? This is a false report. Nelepivka is between Toretsk and New York, and Russian forces would not only have to move through dense Ukrainian defenses, but also face multiple water obstacles and unfavorable terrain. A drive this deep into the Ukrainian defensive lines would have generated significantly more interest in the information space. In the Avdiivka operational area, according to the Russian MOD, elements of the Russian First Army Corps attempted to advance on Spartak. Some more assessment. Spartak was on the Minsk II agreement boundary and had been under Russian control for months. Or so we thought. We did not change the war map, and will continue to monitor this area. War Gonzo made its daily claim about fighting continuing in Vodyana and Pervomaiske with no change in the situation. In the Marinka operational area, a day after the self-declared leader of the so-called Donetsk People's Republic, or DNR, Denis Pushilin, made new claims that Marinka would be captured soon, War Gonzo reported that Ukrainian forces were, quote, in the city, and Rybar reported, quote, the front line temporarily froze, end quote. A quick sidebar for Pushilin, if you're listening. Maybe don't make a capture is coming soon claim on the same day that the First Army Corps releases a video of a Russian tank fighting in the exact area you claim there aren't any Ukrainian forces. Maybe you should coordinate that kind of stuff beforehand. In the Uhledar operational direction, the Russian offensive toward the city remains stalled. On January 29th, we shared a report from insurgents in Mariupol that 3,000 Russian Mobiks had been moved to Volnovakha, south of Uhledar. The GSAFU believes these troops were mobilized as replacement forces to continue attacking the areas north of the Kashlahach River, including northwest Pavlivka. Okay, another assessment. The Russian forces were likely meant for a different operational area. Despite heavy losses and stronger-than-anticipated Ukrainian defenses, Russian commanders appear committed to continuing frontal attacks on Uhledar. The GSAFU reported that the Makilske Dachas were shelled, increasing our confidence that Russian forces do not, in fact, have established positions north of the Kashlahach River. Donetsk Oblast Governor Kirilenko reported that Shevchenko was shelled, damaging 5 homes. Because Shevchenko had fewer than 10 homes before the attack, we assess the settlement is under Ukrainian military control. In the Velika Novosilka operational area, the Russian MOD claimed that Russian troops made continued attempts to advance on Novosilka. In Russian-occupied Mariupol, insurgents reported a Russian convoy of 25 vehicles carrying infantry fighting vehicles, or IFVs, ammunition, and troops passing through the city in the Bryansk direction. I just have one last note before we move on. The Russian MOD reported that Russian forces attacked Mirna, but did not specify which village. Ukraine has over 90 towns named Mirna. Moving on to Zaporizhia. In the morning, Two large explosions were reported at the Refma factory in Melitopol, which Russian forces have used as a logistical center. Pictures from insurgents showed a column of smoke rising in the factory area. In the evening, four more explosions were reported in the city center. Heavy shelling was reported along the axis from the Zaporizhia-Donetsk administrative border to Huliapola to Orekhiv. The situation at the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant is still unchanged. In the Black Sea, Crimea, Mykolaiv, and Odessa region, Operational Command South, or OCS, reported the Black Sea Fleet had 13 ships on patrol, including three missile carriers, two surface vessels, and a Kilo-class submarine, capable of launching up to 20 caliber cruise missiles. Wargonzo reported that Ukrainian forces heavily shelled Hidoyske on the Kinburn Spit. In western and central Ukraine, in Kherson, Russian and Ukrainian forces continued mutual shelling across the Dnipro River. Russian forces executed 34 fire missions on Free Ukraine, targeting the city of Kherson twice, wounding four. Local social media reports claimed Stanislav was hit by Russian artillery. Restoration at the Trifonovskaya solar power plant continues. Russian forces sabotaged the facility and destroyed 20% of the panels during their withdrawal on November 8th. Repair work has restored 50% of the plant's capacity. Output could be raised to 67%, but the electrical substation requires additional repairs. East of the Dnipro River, a Russian source reported Hola Pristan was shelled, and rockets fired by HIMARS struck Pershopokrovka. Social media reports claimed that Kakhovka was also shelled. In Chelburda, a Russian Tor M2D2 from the Russian 80th Arctic Motor Rifle Brigade was destroyed by drone-directed artillery. There is a video, which some people may find graphic. In Dnipropetrovsk, Maximivka was hit by dozens of artillery shells in the morning. There weren't any injuries, but the settlement suffered heavy damage. In north and northeast Ukraine, Vyacheslav Chaus, Cherniv Oblast administrative and military governor, reported four civilians in Yeline were killed and one wounded when a 120-millimeter mortar fired from across the international border struck their home. The people were sheltering in the cellar, but the round penetrated the structure and detonated where they were hiding. 120-millimeter mortars also hit the border village of Vovkivka. The border areas of Sumy were hit by 129 mortar and artillery shells, striking the Hromadas of Shalahin, Esmin, Bilopilia, and Velika Pisarivka. Despite the barrage, there were no injuries or significant damage reported. On the Russian front, Russia accused Ukraine of shelling the Novozybkovo pumping station on the Druzhba oil pipeline in the Bryansk Federal District. A Transneft representative told the Russian state media agency TASS that the pipeline continued to operate normally and the pumping station was only used for a few hours in 2022.
You're listening to the Malcontent News Russia-Ukraine War Podcast. Our team of journalists, researchers, and analysts is funded by readers, listeners, and viewers just like you. To support independent journalism, please consider becoming a patron. You can find us on patreon.com at Malcontent News.
Let's talk about developments theater-wide and outside Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin, who continues to struggle to put the goal of the special military operation in clear, specific, and achievable terms, announced the top priority is to, quote, eliminate the very possibility of shelling the border areas, end quote, adding that it was, quote, the business of the military department, end quote. Oleksiy Reznikov, the Minister of Defense of Ukraine, believes that Russia is preparing for a major offensive from the south and east, quote, around February 24th, and says Russia has amassed 500,000 troops in and just outside of Ukraine. Reznikov said, quote, they officially declared about 300,000, but when we see their troops at the border, according to our estimates, it is much more, end quote. Mateusz Morawiecki, Prime Minister of Poland, echoed Kyiv's concerns, saying, quote, I think that the plan of Putin and his people, such as Valery Gerasimov, is to encircle Ukraine. And while preparing all these plans, he means Putin, probably thinks that he needs to attack from two or three different fronts. Therefore, I believe that Ukrainians cannot rule out an attack from Belarus to encircle Kyiv from the west. End quote. Ukrainian lawyer Andriy Novak confirmed that videos showing men being issued an on-the-spot summons for military conscription in Odessa and Lviv are real and claimed they are illegal, telling the Ukrainian TV channel TSN, quote, "When people were forcibly put into cars, this can be called illegal deprivation of liberty." End quote. The military commissar of the Lviv region, Oleksandr Tyshenko, defended the practice, claiming that serving legal summons in public places is not against Ukrainian law. Tyshenko said that the only people being served in a public setting are conscripts who received a legal summons but didn't report to a recruitment center, forcing commissars to deliver summons in public. Colonel Roman Horbach, head of the personnel department of the headquarters of the Command of the Ground Forces of the Armed Forces of Ukraine, answered a question at a Kyiv press conference about the potential of those deemed eligible only for limited military service due to health issues to be conscripted in the future. He replied, quote, "Those conscripts who are limitedly fit for military service in wartime can be mobilized, but their service will not take place in combat units, but in military support units. They can also serve in institutions and educational institutions of the Ministry of Defense, territorial recruitment and social support centers, and other non-combat units." End quote. Georgi Reshetilov, Mykolaiv Oblast's first deputy administrative and military governor, may be named the new Kherson Oblast governor. Ukrainian media reported that Mykolaiv Oblast Governor Vitaly Kim and President Zelensky discussed the matter on January 31st. Ukraine and France signed an agreement to receive two Groundmaster MG-200 radars for Ukrainian air defense from the Thales Group. The MG-200 is a multi-role medium-range mobile air defense radar with a range of 250 kilometers that can detect and warn of low and high-altitude missile threats, track multiple targets, and calculate the potential impact area for drones and cruise and ballistic missiles. Spain announced it would transfer 20 M113 armored personnel carriers, or APCs, to Ukraine, which will arrive on February 6th. Spanish officials shared the disappointing news that only 6 German-made Leopard 2A4 tanks can be made combat-ready. The remaining 102 reportedly have deteriorated to scrap metal. German Defense Minister Boris Pistorius rode on a Leopard, that being a German Leopard, 2A6 main battle tank, or MBT, slated for Ukraine. During the photo opportunity, Pistorius said that Ukrainians would start training on, quote, Leopards, in Munster soon, and would take an accelerated course. In an interview with CNN, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he was, quote, certainly looking into providing Ukraine with the Iron Dome air defense system. Iron Dome is designed to intercept rockets similar to Grad, Smerch, and Tornado S, as well as SRBMs such as the Tochka-U, also known as a Scud, and Iskander. Netanyahu also hinted his country was behind recent explosions at Iranian weapons manufacturing sites, stating, quote, Israel also, frankly, acts in ways that I will not itemize here against Iran's weapons productions, which are used against Ukraine. End quote. Former British Prime Minister Boris Johnson urged London to provide Ukraine with more tanks, long-range missiles, and fighter planes to save lives and shorten the war. Responding to Johnson, Ben Wallace, Secretary of State for Defense of the United Kingdom, said that transferring fighter jets to Ukraine, quote, would not be the right approach, end quote, adding that no final decision has been reached. Previously, we reported about a video showing Ukrainian troops training to deploy from Chinook CH-47 helicopters. The official explanation is that Ukrainian trainees were not involved, and the person pictured was an Estonian soldier who had previously traded patches with a Ukrainian. Speaking of not being involved, let's talk about Russian mobilization. Just days after Russian milbloggers roasted Kyiv for implementing restrictions on government officials traveling outside of Ukraine, they fell silent. PMC Wagner Group leader Yevgeny Prigozhin sent a letter to Vasily Piskarev, chairman of the committee of the State Duma of the Federal Assembly of the Russian Federation, asking for the same legislation. Prigozhin wants to prohibit government officials and deputies of the Duma from vacation travel outside of Russia and to legislate and investigate, quote, immoral behavior, including close relatives who have engaged in flamboyant spending and abuse of luxury goods, end quote. Some assessment here. A corrupt Russian billionaire oligarch with the blood of thousands on his hands from three continents does not care about corruption. Prigozhin asking for this legislation is political theater aimed at the populace. Our team is pretty sure he's far less corrupt than Russian Minister of Defense Sergei Shoigu, but he's still corrupt to the core and would never survive a similar investigation if it was done without interference. Our favorite FSB colonel, convicted war criminal, Kremlin pariah, PMC Wagner target, and failed Mobik, Igor Girkin-Strelkov, appears to suggest that Russian Mobiks should refuse to fight because they'll likely be killed anyway and prison still means you're alive, asking, quote, what, they will put you in jail when they, he means Ukraine, bombard you with 155-millimeter shells, when your arms and legs fly off before your eyes and you can't hide anywhere, what does it mean to serve 5 years in prison, end quote. Quick question. Is Strelkov projecting? Is he convincing himself that life imprisonment after a conviction at The Hague isn't so bad? Though, to be fair, he wouldn't have to serve his time in a Russian prison, so that's a win. In words that should concern the crumbling CSTO alliance, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said it was, quote, unlikely Moscow would call on alliance members to provide military support in Ukraine. He said, quote, I think that this will not necessarily happen in the future because we do not see the need in terms of equipping our armed forces and how they work in the special military operation. End quote. Everything is going to plan. In our war crimes and human rights segment, we discuss events that might be upsetting to hear about. There is no graphic detail in today's report, but if you are sensitive to descriptions of human rights abuses, please feel free to skip ahead to the next segment. Timestamps are in the description. Russian milbloggers accused Ukraine of committing a war crime after the Nikolo-Vasilyevsky Monastery in Mykolaivka was shelled on January 27th, killing a priest and a nun. In our assessment, there is significant evidence that Ukraine made every attempt to avoid shelling the holy site, and Russian forces had turned it into a military compound. Okay, so let's rewind a little bit. On December 6th, Semyon Pegov of Wargonzo visited the monastery, which we reported in our situation report and on the podcast. We adjusted our war map based on Pegov's visit because it confirmed that Russian forces had full control of Mykolaivka. During that visit, the monastery was undamaged, with the sound of artillery fire close by. Geolocated and weather-confirmed video from January 27th shows that Russian forces had positioned military assets, including infantry fighting vehicles, in the monastery compound and at a building just east of the church. The video recorded by Ukrainian forces clearly shows Russian troops using the area to hide military equipment during the first day of the assault on Uhledar. The area remains under Russian control. In Kramatorsk, an Iskander-M SRBM struck the city's center, destroying an apartment building. At the time of recording, rescue operations continued, with three reported dead, 20 wounded, 8 hospitalized, and up to 10 still missing. Ivan Fedorov, the exiled mayor of Melitopol, reported that 10 civilians were able to escape into free Ukraine by sneaking across the line of conflict north of Vasilivka. The Russian Federation has refused to open the so-called Road of Life into free Ukraine after shutting the checkpoint on December 15th. There was outrage in Ukraine over the news of a death of a 12-year-old in Bakhmut, despite the Donetsk People's Republic ordering all civilians to evacuate in August. Officials say there are 5,990 civilians left in the city, including 200 children. A woman from Kostyantynivka recently appealed to the police to evacuate her 17-year-old daughter from Bakhmut. When police arrived, they found out the teenager lived with her father and a friend and refused to leave her dad. During their visit, Russian artillery started landing in the area, forcing police and the family to hide in their cellar. After the barrage, they convinced the girl and her friend to leave, but her father refused. The evacuation had to be done in an armored vehicle. If you or a loved one are in Bakhmut and want to leave, you can contact the White Angel Evacuation Group at 066-5615-102. In geopolitical news, the condition of former President of Georgia, Mikhail Saakashvili, has improved after he was transferred from prison to a hospital on January 31st. Saakashvili, who's being treated for COVID-19, was conscious and mobile in a series of photographs. Lithuanian Foreign Minister Gabrielius Landsbergis called on all European countries to expel Russian ambassadors, saying, quote, "There is little point left in keeping the Russian ambassador in any of the European capitals. In most cases, this, the Russian embassy, is no longer a diplomatic institution, but a propaganda institution that covers up war crimes and promotes genocide." Current Georgian president Salome Zurabishvili declared that the former Soviet republic would not provide weapons to Ukraine, but also declared that the breakaway republics of South Ossetia and Abkhazia would return to Georgia, and demanded that the Russian Federation withdraw their troops. She also said that, quote, "the complete defeat of Moscow in Ukraine is inevitable." Russian ambassador to the United States, Anatoly Antonov, said that Russia is prepared to negotiate with Ukraine, but requires, quote, "reinforced concrete security guarantees," adding the United States is not ready to provide them. On the same day, Russian Federation State Duma Speaker Valentina Matvienko also said that Moscow was ready to negotiate with Kyiv, saying, quote, "our position is clear, intelligible, and transparent. We are ready for negotiations, without the preconditions that they, Ukraine, are trying to put forward. Negotiations are negotiations if the Kyiv regime is ready for real negotiations, but we do not see this." End quote. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan reaffirmed that his nation would not ratify Sweden's application to join NATO. Hungary and Turkey are currently blocking Finland and Sweden from joining the defensive alliance. In economic news, DTEK announced that 60 million kilowatt-hours of electricity was imported from Europe to help deal with the ongoing deficit in January. Historically warm weather has reduced consumption, enabling other European nations to support Ukraine. DTEK stated that imports could increase to 1 billion kilowatt-hours in the future, enough to supply 4 million households. Turkey announced it was closing its airport to Boeing commercial aircraft operated by Russian airlines after accusations that aircraft were being serviced between flights to avoid sanctions. Turkey said the ban was being implemented because the aircraft are stolen and, by international treaty, are not allowed to land at Turkish airports when used for commercial service. The ruble was unchanged, with an exchange rate of 70 for one U.S. dollar. Western oil prices declined, with WTI crude falling to $77 a barrel and Brent dropping to $83. Russian Urals crude was steady, with an official price of $56 a barrel. United States wholesale RBOB gasoline on the spot market dropped on the first day of February, hitting $2.46 a gallon or 65 cents a liter. Dutch TTF natural gas futures were unchanged, with March 2023 holding at €57 per megawatt hour and April 2023 futures at €58. Chicago SRW wheat futures continued to climb in very volatile trading, hitting $7.70 a bushel for May 2023 delivery. And that's what we know. Join me again tomorrow for more updates. Until then, stay safe, everyone.
You've been listening to the Malcontent News Russia-Ukraine War Podcast. To help keep us independent, please consider providing financial support by becoming a patron. Want on-demand news in your hand? Download the Google News app and make Malcontent News one of your favorites to receive breaking news updates. Thank you for listening.